الله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5, and Intelsat 39, and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Now, while the world has rallied and boycotted, sat in and walked out, yelled and interrupted, expressed every form of protest to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza, it still seems we're not any closer to ending the misery of the Palestinian civilian population there. Sources close to the latest round of indirect ceasefire talks between Hamas and the Zionist entity in Qatar that started last Sunday aren't too upbeat about the way things are going. They say the Israeli delegation presented a withdrawal map that in reality outlines redeployment and repositioning of occupation forces. They said that Hamas has rejected the plan as it essentially legitimizes the reoccupation of approximately half of all of Gaza turning it into isolated zones. Now, the state of affairs in Gaza and stalled efforts to change things there are the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for your guests. Joining us, Mr. Mazen Koumsiye, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. And also Saad Nimr, professor of political science, joining us at Abirza University in occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Mr. Koumsiye, we'll start with you out there in Bethlehem. Perhaps the time around Zionist leadership thought that after, more unprecedented barbarity, that Palestinians will accept anything, they thought, in Qatar from last Sunday up until today. And apparently that has not been the case. Your thoughts on why we're still, though, nowhere near securing a ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, clearly the Israeli government, and not just Netanyahu, as a full government, has never been interested in ending this war. They have a war that they think they can win. They think they can ethnically cleanse Gaza in stages, whether it's summarily moving them out of Gaza at the first instance or moving them to Rafah and creating concentration camp or a combination of genocide / ethnic cleansing. And with the full support of the United States, I think they can succeed in this. So they are proceeding as such. They are not interested in any kind of quote-unquote ceasefire, because a ceasefire implies, as the Palestinians and the international world, the global community wants, is a ceasefire leading to end of the hostilities, leading to the end of the occupation of the Gaza Strip. And as you described, Israel wants to occupy 40% of the Gaza Strip, break it into pieces, and piecemeal continue the genocide and the ethnic cleansing, perhaps with a 60-day quote-unquote ceasefire, if it's acceptable to the resistance that they have a ceasefire that's temporary and that leads to renewal of hostilities, as happened before, and renewal of the genocide. So this is not acceptable to the Palestinian people.
Good initial points there. Professor Nimr, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program, sir. And your initial take, please, on why the U.S. and Israeli leadership at this point feel no sense of urgency at all to end the bloodshed and secure a ceasefire. The Israeli prime minister says it's Hamas's fault. They've been holding out all week, not accepting. Well, why would they accept it if it keeps your occupation forces inside of Gaza, in the middle of Gaza, in fact, in essence, partitioning Gaza? Who would accept that? And, I mean, that would add more of a risk and instability factor to the future for Palestinians there than it would give them Gaza back.
Good evening, Daniel, and also to your guests from Bethlehem and to all your viewers. Well, it's quite obvious that the Israelis are stalling all these kind of negotiations. They are not interested now in ending the war. It's not only the government and the right wing in the government, but also Netanyahu himself, because he couldn't achieve what he wanted from this war, or from this war against Gaza, this genocidal war. The idea from Netanyahu's point of view and vice versa, the Americans, is that they want a kind of victory. He wants to declare a victory somehow, and victory can't be attained. He failed so far in Gaza after more than 20 months in releasing any of the prisoners or to end the rule of Hamas or the strength of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. So consequently, he wants to get that by the negotiations. And that's why he's putting all these kind of new conditions to the negotiations in order to pressurize the Palestinian resistance in the negotiations through the also the Qataris and the Egyptian and the Americans, especially with Witkoff. So what's going on now and why the Americans and the Israelis, in spite of what they are talking about, you know, stopping the war, they want to stop the war. But from their point of view, this ceasefire for 60 days, and that will give Israel the right, or Netanyahu, to resume the war immediately after the 60 days. He could get a half of the prisoners captured by the Palestinian resistance, but at the same time, he won't give in return what the Palestinian resistance wants. In this case, it's three cases, three issues. First of all, the total withdrawal from of the Israeli army from Gaza, a ceasefire, not a ceasefire, end the war in Gaza, and to have guarantees that Israel is not going back to war after 60 days. And the third thing is about the humanitarian aid, which is supposed to be free from the Israeli hands, if you like, and the American companies, and to be returned back to the international organizations. These are the three issues that the Palestinian resistance insists on, while in Israel they are still talking about these three issues as an impossible to achieve.
And Mr. Kumsia, let's ask why Hamas wants the distribution of aid taking out of the hands of the U.S. and the Israelis. UNICEF, the World WHO, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, the WFP, UNRWA, these are UN agencies with the infrastructure and the expertise to facilitate aid distribution in Gaza, more than any of them, UNRWA. Now, you've taken out of the hands of these experts, you put it into the hands of U.S. contractors, as Tel Aviv and Washington have, contractors many people refer to as mercenaries. As a result, over 800 starving Palestinian aid seekers have been killed by Israeli forces at these so-called aid distribution centers. We have even UN rights experts calling these aid sites death traps.
Indeed, these are death traps, and this is described not just by the United Nations, but also by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and others who, you know, in the international human rights organizations that looked at this situation. This is unacceptable. It's unacceptable to international aid agencies, unacceptable to the UN, and to all decent human beings who looked at this. They realize this is a scam. This is not an aid. It's a scam to basically lure Palestinians and then kill them while claiming they are allowing aid so that they get off the docket of the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice. That is just a scam, no more and no less. And it's an Israeli-American scam, not just an Israeli scam. In fact, there is American mercenaries who are manning these, and many of them are shooting Palestinians waiting for aid. You know, deciding, Palestinians have to decide, I die either by hunger or I die by bullets. Which one do I want to take my chances with? So I think that's a horrific choice to make. And it is basically what is being offered us as Palestinians. Israel is moving along, as I said, with its plan. And because of the Epstein files and all of this, they know that they have the U.S. administration's subsequent ones, whether it's Clinton or Trump, under their thumb, because the Mossad can blackmail them and release any of the tapes that Epstein and others have recorded on them. So they feel very comfortable that the U.S. will stand with them on all steps and all processes of ethnic cleansing and continuing genocide.
And thank you, Mr. Kumsi. And Professor Nimmer, can you please also weigh in on these so-called death traps, these so-called aid distribution centers? Why take them out of the hands of these UN agencies, these experts that have been doing this for dozens of years? What objectives does this fulfill for the U.S. and the Zionists? And why do we have to witness 800 people starving, hungry people that want to feed their families get killed seeking aid in Gaza?
Yes, from the very beginning, they wanted this method of distributing the humanitarian aid is to be in their hands in order to control the people in Gaza. It's quite clear, they said that many times, that we need to have the ID cards of all those who are coming into the areas designed to distribute the aid, and we will consider who's going in or who's going out. It's a mean of control. People are starving, people are in hunger, and yet at the same time, the Israeli are deciding who's going to take this kind of food in order to control. They claim that they don't want this distribution of aid, humanitarian aid, to go in the hands of the Palestinian resistance, but this is not true. It's the whole thing is to control the Palestinians, and now it became quite obvious after they declared their plan of keeping the crossing of Morag and in south of Gaza till Philadelphia, which is include Rafah. This area, they want to keep it, and they don't want to redeploy or to withdraw from this area in order to create what they call it, the humanitarian city. So they will let people in, around 600,000 in the first stage, and they will distribute food on them. They will allow them in by their ID cards, and once they are in, they can't get out. So it is a concentration camp, and after that, we never know. It's part of a plan to ethnically cleanse this area, and to, according to the Israelis, they said there is a third country who's willing to take the Palestinians, so they will push Palestinians out of this area directly to this third country, and in this case, they are disposing of one-third of the population in Gaza. And then they will repeat the same thing again in order to bring, and because of that, they need to control the food. They need to control the real life of the Palestinians in terms of the humanitarian aid, in order to control them to do so and to go to this humanitarian city, as they call it. So it's part of the plan for the ethnically cleansing of Palestinians, and because of that, they are making that very important. Otherwise, if the Palestinians have their aid coming from international organizations, which they have no conditions at all against the Palestinians, and they can have it free and directly and distributed in all over Gaza Strip, it means there is no control for Israel over the Palestinian using the weapon of hunger and weapon of starvation against the Palestinians.
And Mr. Kumsi, you notice every single day 80 to 100 Palestinians are being slaughtered in Gaza lately. You saw the coffee shop earlier this week, the clinic strewn with children's bodies after Israel's airstrike there, the gas station. Right now, I mean, and just earlier today, here's another headline: Israeli drone kills at least 12 people in Gaza City's food market attack, including a top surgeon. Why is it every time we witness an opportunity for a ceasefire to somewhat materialize, it's accompanied by a dramatic increase in the level of barbarism by the occupation?
Well, clearly the Israeli regime is very interested in maximizing number of people killed and number of people injured. We have to remember, for each 100 Palestinian killed daily, there's at least 300 to 400 Palestinians who are injured, most of them with injuries that are debilitating, like losing limbs. And now Gaza has the highest child amputee rate in the world, number of children amputees in the world. This horrific situation that Israel is engaged in, including using banned weapons and using new weapons that they test. That's the Gaza laboratory. They test weapons on the Gaza population. The idea is extermination. That's all it is. And the world community needs to be ashamed of itself, sitting around watching these governments, like the Western governments, who spout sometimes words about local suffering, when they really understand that what's going on has not been done even in the past 100 years before, including in the Second World War. There was never a genocide at this scale, using starvation and thirst and denial of medicines to people, obliterating all the healthcare facilities so that they cannot even treat the injured people and they have to do amputations without anesthesia. This is the horror of what we are witnessing. And my friends in Gaza who lost relatives, one of them, Sacher, lost both his parents and his brothers, and they're littered. The rest of them, the survivors, are literally starving and so weak they cannot take the risk to go to the so-called aid distribution death traps. He told me that I would go because I'm willing to die, because death may be more merciful than hunger. This is the reality that's happening as we speak in Gaza, day in and day out. This is day 645 of this accelerating genocide.
Thank you, Mr. Kumsia. And Professor Nimr, and you notice the only people fighting for the women and children of Gaza are Palestinian resistance. I mean, with the escalation of violence by the occupation throughout the last few days and weeks, we've seen retaliatory operations also increase by the resistance, leading to some serious losses for invading Israeli forces. The fact that Hamas is still in a position to say no to an unjust and unfair ceasefire deal that will not benefit Palestinians and still carry out a strong response to this escalation in this violence, what does that say about the resistance today in Gaza?
I think this is the most important issue, and that is the issue which is going really to force Israel to stop the war for many reasons. First of all, there were some studies about, you know, the conduct of the Palestinian resistance since the resuming of the war against Gaza. And they said in the first month, at least, you know, there was, you know, like every week one operation, sometimes, you know, more than even 10 days to have an operation against the Israeli troops. But now we are talking exactly since June and July that there is an escalation in the situation. This escalation caused you know, lots of damage to the Israeli army. That proven that now the numbers is talking about itself, that the Palestinian resistance now is doing three or four sometimes big operations, I mean, in Gaza a week, and sometimes more than that, and sometimes also two or three in a day. And that inflict lots of casualties among the Israeli army. We are talking about, you know, in June alone, there were 20 soldiers were killed. July, we are talking till today, more than 12 soldiers were killed, and we are at the beginning of July. So with this rate, it's really, really very hard for the Israeli army. The Channel 12, which is known in Israel as a BRU government and BRU Netanyahu and the right wing, they conducted a kind of a survey among Israeli soldiers in the army. And they talk about, you know, lots of problems, and they are tired, fatigued, and that they can't do the job. And also the upper groups of the army, they said that they are assigning, you know, to us some assignments which is really not for our expertise. So it means that they don't have new targets apart from killing the civilian. And the Israeli army is really now facing lots of problems, including the lack of lots of soldiers to be in the army as well. And especially that this report, in spite of the fact that the Israeli army officially, they said we have 10,000 casualties among the Israeli army. The report said in this Channel 12 that there is 20,000 casualties among the Israeli army, that they lost them and now they can't go back to fight. In addition to that, not recruiting the Haredim in the army, that make the army really in a very, very bad situation, and we can see that quite clear.
And I'd like, Mr. Kumsi, if you could please weigh in on that question as well. We see so many Israelis even asking for an end to the genocide. They want to see their captives back. They want to see an end to this thing, not because they care so much for Palestinian lives, because they care about becoming more of a pariah and isolated in the international community. So they want Benjamin Netanyahu to wrap this thing up in Gaza. You have Israel's closest allies asking for a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, bring the onslaught to an end in Gaza. But Zionist leadership do not listen, which brings us to the point, we hear it often, that Israel only understands the language of force. How basically significant do you see Hamas's role along with Islamic Jihad in what they're doing today for Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, clearly, if we are looking at Israeli public opinion, there's still 82% of Israelis support the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Mm. And the vast majority of Israelis still support the genocide in Gaza. They may differ on the tactics. So the opposition, for example, to Netanyahu, thinks that the tactic should be a withdrawal from Gaza interim, and then we can always go back into Gaza. This is what they argue. So it's a difference on the tactics, not on the goals, which continues to be to obliterate the Palestinian people and any semblance of resistance within the Palestinian people. However, what has happened since October 2023, really, is that the idea that Israel can proceed as it wants with ethnic cleansing that started in 1948 and continued for some 78 years now, and can continue with this with impunity, has reached an end point, because clearly this idea that we are an invincible army and nobody dares attack us was shattered on October 7, 2023. And then it continues to be shattered, because here we are bombarding Gaza, as I said, leveling Gaza for 645 days, and they still have losses. Israeli soldiers are being killed. This shows the futility of crushing a resistance. You cannot crush a resistance. That doesn't happen historically. I'm a historian also. And I know that historically it never happened in the past that you would completely crush a resistance of an indigenous people who are fighting against a colonial racist power, whether it was in South America, South Africa, or Vietnam, or any other country, Algeria. Okay. This doesn't happen. So that's what I think.
We have
is a lesson being learned And I hope it trickles to the Israeli public and the Israeli leadership.
Thank you.
That they cannot win against the Palestinians by military might.
Thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Mr. Mazin Qumsie joining us from Occupied Bethlehem, and Professor Saad Nimr, they're joining us from Occupied Ramallah. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, welcome once again to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab, grateful as always to be here with you. The show is about reconnecting with our purpose as parents and mentors grounded in the sacred guidance of Holy Quran, the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the noble words of our imams. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon them. Well, in this program, we try to answer questions, and the topics we discuss basically to guide the parents to be best mentors in Islamic education. And we take advices from our guest expert. Today, we have the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Brother Liaqat Abbas is a research scholar in the House of Ilmi of Qom, and also he has a background in psychology, which makes him the perfect guest for our program. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, when talking about Islamic upbringing, is it different when it goes for boys and when it goes for girls?
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, of course, the upbringing of a boy differs from a girl, you know, in Islam. There are certain things which needs to be taught to a boy, and there are certain things which needs to be focused when it comes to a girl, yeah?
So when it comes to gender, there's difference?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, there's gender-specific upbringing.
All right.
In Shia Islam. Of course, there are common grounds as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about gender-specific upbringing. Because in the religion of Islam, few duties are upon the shoulder of a male. Example, taking up responsibilities, earning, everything, yeah? So because it's wajib, when it comes to the concept of obligatory things, then it's upon the male, that it's obligatory upon the male that he should be the bread earner,
yeah.
He should earn, and he should provide it for his family.
Right.
Unlike the female, for the female, it's not wajib. So
right.
Even if she doesn't work, she won't be asked on the day of judgment, yeah?
Right.
So you see, this is over here itself, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is making specific, like, okay, you know what? This is what you need to know.
It's a major responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. As for the girl, of course, the load of tarbiyah or upbringing, like from a real infant stage of the baby, falls upon her. You know, like the mother is the role model for the baby. The mother is the real upbringer when the baby is really small. So definitely the things of wisdom and like how to raise the child and how to be with the child, how to be emotional, loving, caring, and how not to be overacting or overreacting, example, upon the baby or what the baby does, should be upon the girl, and she should be knowing everything. Yeah.
Right.
So there's a kind of difference between both of course, even the boy, I mean, like, even the male should be knowing it. But the major responsibility, because the mother is always with the child.
Right.
So it depends like how I am upbringing my child. Example, if I upbring my child like my boy, okay, mm-hmm. if it is a male, in the manner that I have to upbring the girl, then the qualities which he should be having when he grows up will be lacking
them.
In him.
All right. Yep. Now there's a point to ponder on that, and we'll take a short break here. We'll be back in a while.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. And Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas is here helping us with valuable insights on Islamic upbringing. Well, Brother, you were talking about the gender difference, like if there's a boy and a girl, the upbringing is not necessarily the same for the both genders. It differs as their roles when they become adults differ. So does the upbringing.
Yep, definitely. So example, if I have a baby girl, example, okay,
yeah.
and I am doing the upbringing like how it should be done, then she's going to become a proper mother when she grows up.
Right.
She's going to become, I would say, the mother which Islam wants her to be.
Right.
You see? So it depends on my upbringing of my baby girl, like when she's really small. And of course, like the process goes on, like when she's 5, 7, 10, 12, you
yeah.
see? So it's very crucial and important for me to know about how to do upbringing, about if it is a male and if it is a female.
So as a mentor, as a guide, as a father, it's very important for you to go through the processes like how the upbringing differs in both genders.
And definitely. The point over here is, unfortunately, people don't think about it. Yeah. Example, like they have...
So maybe there's lack of awareness or...
Maybe they don't have like awareness, yeah, of course. But other than that, they're not even interested sometimes. Like few people are not even interested. They just do upbringing.
Because, you know, real nurturing takes efforts.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
No one is like always ready to make more efforts or...
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately.
But we as parents and mentors will be asked tomorrow.
Sorry?
We will be asked tomorrow.
Definitely, we will be asked tomorrow. And the general concept is they do upbringing equally. Like, they just, okay, you know what? They are growing, so let them grow. Be it male or female, doesn't mm-hmm. matter. They do it on common grounds, yeah? Unfortunately. Of course, few might teach their girls, example, like few arts or few specific things, example,
skills.
Like skills, yeah, exactly. Like sewing the clothes, stitching the clothes, example. And for the boys, example, they might teach them about swimming or whatever, okay? But this is like a very basic thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is like mostly material. But when it comes to upbringing, like on the real basis, I would say, like what they have to teach to their kids, then they lack the skills over there, unfortunately. So over here, the first responsibility, if it is a male, is the father or the mother, the parents should teach about leadership, because
All right.
he should do the management of the house, and not just the general leadership inside the house, okay? Even financial management,
All
yeah?
Right.
House management, everything, like with regards to management. Okay, if you want to purchase something, like the father should take the child, if it is a male, should take the child with him to the market, should teach him, okay, this fruit is good, this vegetable is good. When you, like, of course, when he grows up a bit, then give a bit of responsibility to the child. Okay, my dear son, Now you choose the fruits, you choose the vegetables for me. I will tell
let
you if it is correct or not.
Yeah.
You see?
So yeah, let's discuss more, but let's take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, a righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and I'm Zainab, your host. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here with us, and we are discussing how the upbringing differs in both genders, male and female. So you were talking about, like, there's lack of awareness, definitely. That's how parents usually go with a common upbringing with both the genders. But you said the results will be also not as desired. So when coming back to male child, you said that we should teach them the management and leadership skills by just practically taking them to the market, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And there are many more, of course, if it is a male. Yeah. If it is a female example, there are skills like cooking and everything, which normally the mothers do. Okay. Unfortunately, there are a few mothers who don't even do this. They're like, oh, you know what? My daughter is too small for this. Even if the daughter is like 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
They're like, no. She's too small. So she should be playing or going to school. And that's it. And the daughter is going to learn cooking after she gets married, which is not a good thing in general aspect, unfortunately. So with regards to women, the main responsibility which falls upon the parents to do upbringing for the female child, is haya, is chastity,
modesty.
Exactly. So because if this is there, this will take that girl, that female child, to heights which no one can ever imagine. This is very important. Haya is very important. This should be taught to the child. Okay, example, tomorrow when this child goes in public and a male approaches, example, okay, maybe it's the classmate, okay? How should this child of yours
react,
respond? Or how should she react or respond? How should she answer? Example, if a male person, example, is asking more questions or is trying to, example, like...
Be more friendly,
yeah, exactly. Or trying to give hands or shake hands or whatever. The child
because
should
not
know.
All cultures are Islamic cultures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they may be exposed to some maybe non-Islamic setup.
Yes.
So they should be ready to respond.
Yes, definitely. So they need to be taught beforehand itself. This is upbringing. This is the part of
because
upbringing.
Because that response is not going to come overnight.
Definitely. It's a very gradual process. I remember a friend of mine who happened to go take her child to masjid, okay? And there were a few girls, like 3 to 4 girls, whose hijab wasn't nice.
Proper hijab,
yeah. So it was improper hijab. And this girl, she's a very modest girl. She started to copy their hijab style.
All right.
And my friend, he got so upset. He was like, oh my God, no, what should
I can't even take to mosque.
You know what? Yeah, exactly. You know, it took him 1 month to change her mindset.
Oh.
From not doing improper hijab to a proper hijab.
So like just a visual scene.
Yeah.
Especially a live visual scene can have that deep impact.
And it took him 1 month. He told me, he shared with me personally. And he was like, it's very difficult to make her understand. So you see, it's not like an overnight process.
Yeah.
And there are more things where you need to teach your, if it is a male boy, like if it is a boy, you have to teach him about leadership, about management. And when he grows 14, example, teach him financial management and everything.
Yeah.
Likewise, if it is a girl, haya, and like how to do tarbiyah. If she sees you doing good tarbiyah, being kind, being like, example, loving, affectionate, she'll also have the same qualities when she gives a child, inshallah.
Yeah, thank you so much, brother.
Thank you.
This brings us to the end of another heartfelt session on Islamic upbringing. I want to thank you, Brother Liaquat Abbas, for being here and for your valuable contributions. And also, dear listeners, it's not just like if you work for hire in your daughters, then you should not be working in that modesty for the boys. But it's like sometimes some values, some virtues are more in a specific gender. So yes, definitely management is something that has to be learned by both the genders, and modesty is something that, again, has to be learned by both the genders. Thank you for tuning in. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
When you travel to a historical city, the goal is not just to visit museums and beautiful monuments, but you want to mix with the locals and learn about their traditions and culture. In recent years, many historical houses in Iran have turned to accommodation places, which are called Rumgardi. These are neither hotels nor hostels. They are local traditional houses that provide the opportunity for their guests to meet with locals and live like locals, even for a short time. Nar Titi is the first house we visited, a beautiful place in the small town of Taft, with several traditional elements. An Iranian Zoroastrian couple owns the house. Traveling also means doing activities that we would not have done elsewhere. Each night, all the travelers who stay in this cozy place meet with the owners of the house, drink tea, and eat freshly picked pomegranate from the backyard. And so, they can experience a little different trip and realize that we all share the same fundamental values and same objectives. We're all part of the same planet, and this makes us stay connected.
Staying at these kinds of places adds to one's understanding of the world and understanding of people. It is something which gives you an understanding that all of us are the same. We're all people. We're much more similar than we are different. And when you start taking governments and other things out of the situation, it's just, we can enjoy being with each other and understanding each other and learning about each other.
Another differentiating element of the house is a wall full of memories of those who stayed a while in this place. A very interesting wall that takes you to a journey around the world.
une nuit dans cette maison est particulièrement est une expérience particulièrement enrichissante puisque ça permet de partager ces expériences entre les différents voyageurs qui se croisent ici.
In Iran, when a guest or loved one leaves our house, we accompany him or her to the door and throw water to show we want him or her to return very soon. With this compassion, we left that beautiful place to discover other local guest houses. The second place is the House of Baran, which means rain in Farsi, a beautiful adobe house that truly represents the city of Yazd. A very simple house, but artistically decorated and perfectly designed with traditional Persian elements that constantly reminds you of the peaceful spirit of Iranians. A beautiful house with very positive energy. There's a logic behind the location of every piece in decorating this guest house. Some of these elements are symbolic and some others are still functional.
This house has lots of interesting features for me as a visitor. So Abbas, the owner of this guest house, had to adjust the stairs and make them more comfortable for us, people of modern age, to be able to walk down. Because apparently, back in the old days, they were building these stairs very high. The underground room, and there is about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius temperature difference, comparing it to upstairs. So making it a perfect room to chill and maybe take a nap during the hot days of summer. Also during the cold days of winter, this is gonna be a very warm room and area of the building. Few steps down and tiny little room even gets cooler. Ideal, perfect place to keep your fruits and vegetables during the hot days of summer. Natural cooling system. You know why? Because it's connected to the wind tower room.
There is always a time to say goodbye to even the most beautiful things in this world. What you take from that location or moment is usually what you see or experience towards the end. An unforgettable taste with a beautiful color and very exciting recipe create an experience that I will take with me from Baran Guest House. The exciting thing about all these traditional guest houses is the fact that they're all different in some ways. One is famous for its traditional elements. One is known for its design and decorations. And the other has some very moving stories about the people who live there, the people who run it now, their families and their relatives. Local people of different regions of Iran, full of love and passion. The most hospitable hosts that I have ever seen in my life. Jahangard Guest House is one of the few places that you can have a unique experience of meeting local elders, hear their stories, and learn about their experiences.
One of the benefits of staying at local guest houses is to have a chance to have this first-hand experience of seeing local handicrafts being made. You see the whole process, and you have a chance to see the craftsman who's behind this precious product, behind making this precious product. And I really enjoy interacting with people, talking to them, and of course learning from them.
One thing is to hear or imagine how life was back in the old days, especially inside these gorgeous traditional guest houses. Another thing is to live the life of those people in those days. It might be some very simple acts, or even sometimes symbolic, but they definitely worth the try. It feels amazing. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.
Thank you. Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aliyas 60 y 61 de la sura de Anfal del Sagrado Corán, recitadas por el señor Rahnema.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa a'iddu lahum mastata'tum min ومن رباط الخيل ترهبون به عدو الله وعدوكم وآخرين من دونهم لا تعلمونهم الله يعلمهم وما تنفقوا من شيء في سبيل الله يوفى إليكم وأنتم لا تظلمون وإن جنحوا للسلم فاجنح لها وتوكل على الله إنه هو السميع العليم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Busco el refugio de Dios ante los engaños del diablo. En el nombre de Dios, el compasivo.